This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joe Cohen from Queens College.
I'm Leslie Hingson from Georgetown University.
And I'm Gabriel Rossman from UCLA.
We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at SocAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Today we meet Jesse Strybe of Duke University. Jesse wrote The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages with Oxford University Press. And more recently, she published The Unbalanced Theoretical Toolkit, Problems and Partial Solutions to Studying Culture and Reproduction, but Not Culture and Mobility in the American Journal of Cultural Sociology. We're going to talk about culture, class, social mobility, and theory. You're not going to want to miss this. So a recent Gallup survey finds that faith in higher education is falling. So the institution of higher education still enjoys relatively high levels of societal confidence, according to Gallup data, but it's falling. In 2015, Gallup found about 57% of Americans had a high level of confidence in higher education. In 2018, 3 years later, that's fallen to 48%. So that's a 9 percentage point swing. And that strikes me as a non-trivial. And that 9-point drop is a product of some smaller drops among political independents and Democrats, about 4 to 6 percentage points, and a much larger 17 percentage point drop among Republicans. So higher education is experiencing some loss in public confidence. It's hitting political conservatives, or I guess Republicans, harder. Is this something we need to care about? Is this something important?
Nah, nobody cares what voters who talk to their state legislatures think.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are two things that I would say to that. Is number one, I think that if Gallup were to actually have a survey question that asks, do you have confidence in anything today? Mm. Right? I think that we actually see that, you know, across the board, I actually think there would be a drop in confidence across the populace in many of our primary institutions. I think that that's just something we'd see. And then the second thing, thinking about higher education more broadly, I mean, you know, if your kids graduated from college and they're still living at home, if your kids graduated from college and they don't have jobs, right, or don't have jobs that'll allow them to move out, if the cost of your kids' college education risks bankrupting you, which, as we've seen, like the rise in the costs of higher education are just ridiculous, right? And then also, too, the proliferation of for-profit online learning, right, which, as we've been seeing more and more, you know, tends to not actually give you any bang for your buck. Mm-hmm. I think there's, you know, we shouldn't be surprised.
From your statement there, I just realized Althea is about 18, right?
Nope.
Oh, okay. Nope. I miscalculated.
Althea's 15, but okay. You know, but Olivia.
Oh, Olivia. That's what I got the yeah. So she's 18. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a sophomore in college.
Okay, so this is why you're thinking this. You just paid the tuition.
Yes, but I got a great deal, I must say.
No, but in all seriousness, is this something like, I get the idea that maybe there's like a general decline in confidence in institutions.
Yeah, but that's been long run.
Yeah. So
I mean, there's been a long run decline in institutional confidence. I mean, it's tricky because a lot of these survey data sets, they start in the early 70s. And as best we can tell, that's also when you saw a decline in confidence in institutions. So the GSS starts in, I think, 72, 73, something like that.
Yeah.
And
with those workhorse variables for all of your intro to stats classes.
Yeah, exactly. Confidence. Well, the workhorse data sets, you know, but as best we can tell, declining confidence in institutions really started with Watergate. Not so much Vietnam, actually, more Watergate. And there's been kind of a long-run decline since. But we can't. It's hard to say that because you can't do that with GSS. There's some time series that go back further, like some of the Gallup polls go back to, I don't know, the 30s, something like that. And I think this actually is a long-running question. And my understanding is that you saw high confidence all through the early 20th century and mid 20th century that tips in the early 70s. And in general, you know, a lot of indicators kind of went to shit around 1972, 1973.
I mean, the other thing that I would note is, I mean, look at the institutions that are put here. I mean, so number one, so the military, right? Yeah. Like 74%, right? You know, have a great deal of confidence in, or quite a lot of confidence in the military, mm-hmm. right? What does that even mean, right? What does that mean that they have a great deal of confidence in the military? Does that mean that they support the military? Does that mean that they think the military will be able to protect us? I'm not even sure how to interpret that. And then the other thing to note is that, you know, higher education like enjoys a great deal more support than public schools do, right? Which is interesting given that public schools educate, you know, like a great deal more, you know, of our populace than institutions of higher education do.
Well, I think people are just thinking they don't do as good of a job.
Yeah. Oh, you mean public schools?
And if you look comparatively, America's higher education system is, you know, includes the world leaders, whereas our primary and secondary education seems to lag behind those of many developed countries.
I want to interject the overall, I think the university system is average here. Like you have, the median system.
Are you staring at your Carleton business BA on your office wall?
With a tear rolling down my cheek. No, the thing is that the system's highly stratified. So this country of 350 million people has, I don't know how many schools in the top 50 and or in the top 100 or 500 as those international rankings go. And you'll find that, you know, England has a bunch, you know, all the major countries are represented kind of in proportion. I don't know if the median school, there's 2,000 colleges here.
I know that U.S. schools dominate the top 25 universities. And I think like there's like three that are outside. There's like University of Tokyo, Cambridge, and Oxford. And like that's it in the top 25. 25,
yeah. So one of the things to note is that it says, I guess they did this polling between June 1st and 13th of this year. Mm-hmm. And I'm noting the presidency, there's 37% tied with the U.S. Supreme Court, right, in terms of having a great deal of or quite a lot of confidence in these two institutions. Mm-hmm. Do we think those numbers still stand now in October of 2018?
I think if you did the poll today, you'd see lower numbers and kind of like the opposite of what we were saying with higher education, you'd see a huge drop among liberals. Hmm. But I also don't think that'll necessarily last. I think there'll be a short-term effect. And, you know, if you were to do it in, you know, March, it would be pretty similar to what you see in this.
But I want to get away from the general institutional stuff and ask, do we have a crisis of confidence in higher ed?
Oh, but just one thing, like this whole idea of like, are there short-term survey administration effects? Is a serious question that's worth taking. I mean, we tend to just say like, oh, this is a 2018 survey. We could just take it as like, well, it's 2018. But, you know, people are attentive to what's happening in the news that day. And I mean, not super attentive. Like, I mean, not everybody is, you know, constantly hitting refresh on Twitter like a rat in a cocaine study. But people, you know, are, if there's like a big issue people are really upset about over a course of like a month, it's going to do it. And so like if there was like a well-publicized shooting, police shooting, that's going to reduce people's confidence in the cops for like a month. And then maybe it'll go back to trend. But, you know, depending on whether or not the survey data was collected during that month when there was a well-publicized shooting, you're going to get different effects. And I've seen some people start to analyze this. In particular, I saw a paper that, you know, that famous finding from like 2004 that doesn't seem to be true about the GSS friendship module of like how many close friends do you have? Mm-hmm. And so one of the explanations I heard for that, so I've seen people replicate that and say it's just not true at all. It's just like a total fluke. That's Claude Fisher's interpretation. But I saw somebody else present a paper saying like that it really goes down during election season. particularly among people who are in the local political minority. And so it's some like, you know, micro period effect of people get mad at each other during elections and they say, I don't have any friends.
Huh.
I mean, it could be. Jesse, do you have any views on this?
No, I mean, that seems reasonable to me. But yeah, I remember seeing that paper. I think it's BK Lee and Peter Bierman.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I wanted to make sure I got both co-authors, but I appreciate you remembering them.
Yeah. Yeah, it made sense to me, but I don't know that we actually know for sure what people are talking about, but it did seem to align with the political season pretty well.
So does that, are we to infer then that there's no, like, this might be a temporary thing? It's just the Republicans are railing on academics and there's no sustained change in...
Well, you know what's funny is 2015 is the baseline. And if you go back and think about it, 2015 was like the year of woke in higher education. that's when you had Nick Christakis getting screamed out in the quad. That's when you had, you know, the University of Missouri basically shutting down.
Do you think those?
It's before you had. It's before you had basically, you know, roving gangs looking to club their biology professors at Evergreen State. But like the single biggest concentration of kind of far left excesses, or at least things that could be taken as far left excesses in higher ed, were in 2015. Although I believe they were mostly in the fall.
Yeah, that's so what I was going to say.
If they also did the survey in June in 2015, it would have been right before that. Mm-hmm. So they would have done it like the last possible minute to get before that wave of kind of campus protests.
Do you think that those events have a lot to do with public perceptions of higher education?
Oh, yeah.
Like more than, okay, let's separate them though. Is it that these specific events have changed the public's view? Or is it that those who want to discredit the academy have chosen those events to showcase as part of a broader campaign to discredit the academy? And were it not those events, they choose something else. And the real causality is academics have become political actors regardless of what they say, right?
I think it's both. I think that you're always going to first of all, I don't think people have, you know, I think there's a real, if a tree falls in the woods, does it make a sound kind of issue? Like if something that would offend you happens, but no kind of like policy, moral entrepreneur draws your attention to it, it kind of doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So, but I also think that, you know, you're going to have people like Campus Reform, you know, coming up with things to get upset about. But if the worst they can do is some lecturer at Podunk State that you've never heard of, you know, said something silly on their syllabus, that's not going to, you know, that's all they'll have to go with. And it's not really going to make that big a deal. But, you know, if you have it that, you know, like that footage of Nick getting screamed at or Nicholas getting screamed at, that's going to draw much more attention. So I kind of feel like you have the moral entrepreneurs, and we don't observe these events without the moral entrepreneurs, but the raw material they have to work with also matters a lot. And that's true of everything. I'm not just saying this of like campus politics. I'm saying anytime you have one group of people, you know, who are basically doing something excessive or unpleasant, and another group of people who want to paint them in an unflattering light, the more material you give your enemies to work with, the worse you're going to look.
Maybe, except sometimes you can spin material up even if you don't have great material, right? Like, what's the basis for attacking climate science, right? That's part of the academy. It's been the subject of...
I wouldn't know about that, right? So, you know, even with the... So, like, yes, there always is attacks on climate science, or there always are attacks on climate science, but they really picked up when there was a WikiLeaks dump showing internal emails from climate scientists saying that they were going to, like, coordinate to spike the peer review of people who were more skeptical of it.
So those who wanted to discredit it had that available to them, but I don't think it drove the opposition or drove the intent of the campaign. Like, there were people looking for reasons to discredit academics.
Yeah, and I think actually that evidence, if I had to bet, those emails were probably stolen by Russian security services and then dumped on WikiLeaks precisely to discredit climate science because, you know, the entire Russian economy is selling oil and gas. So,
right. Or like, know, in economic policy, right? The idea that tax cuts, I don't think they're widely believed to stimulate economic growth or prosperity, but there's a preconceived agenda that you have. And if the scientists aren't on your side and they're arguing against it, you have a reason to want to discredit them.
Well, I'm just going to interject here. And I actually think that, you know, the biggest news here, right, is, you know what I mean? Of course, you know, I think that we can expect to see a bit of a drop because it seems as though I think Americans are exhibiting lower levels of faith in institutions across the board. The real news story here, I kind of think, is like the significant like difference in the confidence drops among Republicans, right? Like, and I think by sort of like investigating that and ferreting that out, right, I think we can get closer to the answer of what explains that and whether or not we are in a moment of crisis. I mean, I think it kind of, I think in some ways lends itself to Gabriel's intuition that it, I mean, may not have to do with, you know, the stuff that was going on campuses in 2015 per se. But, you know, I think there had been this sort of almost decades long at this point in time, you know, sort of, I think sort of battle, right, between, for example, the proponents of free speech, right, and, you know, and the ones who were all the way on one end of the spectrum and those all the way on the other end of the spectrum, right, you know, grappling with, you know, things like white privilege, right, you know, it's like the aughts, you know, that was the decade of, you know, I kind of feel like of introducing this idea of white privilege broadly across campuses, right? You know, are Democrats more likely to say, okay, fine, you know, maybe I can accept that than Republicans? I'd bet the farm on that. So,
well, it's interesting that you brought up this whole idea of, you know, race and inequality and partisan differences in that, because there was a time series of attitudes. Okay, so there's this one question in the standard batteries. I forget if it's ANES or GSS. I think it's GSS. But there, anyway, there's a question that basically asks some variation on how much racial inequality do you think is caused by racism? Mm-hmm. And if you go back to the aughts, it was at relatively low levels, and there was a fairly tight consensus between Republicans and Democrats. Democrats were more likely to answer yes to that question, right, to say that the main source of racial inequality is racism. But we're talking like 20% for Republicans versus 30% for Democrats, something like that. Mm-hmm. Starting in 2008, it had a sustained climb through 2016 among Democrats and a slight drop among Republicans. But it went from something like 30% to something like 70% among Democrats during the Obama years. So, you know, there's a case that, you see a similar divergence. Mm-hmm. Actually, a much bigger one than what we're talking about with the higher ed, although the higher ed thing is just one, you know, a smaller time span. So in terms of the why do we care thing, so let's just take this as, you know, an established fact and think about like, why does it matter? And also like what's behind it. I feel like institutions are weak when they are seen as partisan. Mm-hmm. You know, to the extent that a institution is seen as partisan, it undermines its credibility. You see this on the other side, by the way, in that liberals and Democrats always hate means testing for transfer programs, because they have this maxim of a program for the poor is a poor program, something like that. I might be, mangling it a little bit. But the idea is that you need a broad base of support for something in order for it to be sustainable. And, to the extent that higher education is seen as a partisan institution, it's going to undermine support for it among the opposition, which, you know, is not going to make it healthy, because eventually that opposition takes power. And, you know, empirically, it is true that most state legislatures and most governors are run by Republicans.
So my response to that, like, is, mm-hmm. you know, okay, like, I totally buy that. But at the same time, does that mean that fewer Americans are going to go to college? Especially given everything that keeps getting pounded into our heads, you know, both in the mainstream media, but also in, you know, sort of academic research that, you know, you kind of just need at least a bachelor's degree to kind of get ahead, if not get ahead, at least maintain, try to hold on to the class position of your parents.
I agree with you that it's not going to change people's, you know, status attainment strategies, that they're still going to go to college. But I think it could have big political effects. And I think you could particularly see state legislatures focus on cost cutting and, you know, reduce.
Like NSF cuts or stuff like they have in Wisconsin, kind of tenure.
Yeah, I mean, we see, you know, cuts to the NSF Social Behavioral Science Division. You know, we see declining support for funding of state, funding of state universities and state legislatures. We could see declining support for student loan programs, right? So basically, I don't think the fact is, I don't think you're going to see somebody who watches a lot of Fox News, you know, see some professor say something stupid on Tucker Carlson and says, "That's it, Junior, you're not going to college." I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think that it is the case that this is going to decrease support through political institutions. And so you're going to see more hostile regulation, some of which is probably deserved, right? But you're going to see more hostile regulation of universities. You're going to see fewer subsidies for them. And in all sorts of ways, you're going to see political institutions undermine them. And I think part of this will be you'll want to see a focus on the teaching mission, particularly the parts of the teaching mission that are seen as legitimate by conservative state legislatures. And drive away from kind of the research mission, especially to the extent that the research mission is seen as not valuable. And so there may be pressure to increase teaching loads because, you know, why are these professors only teaching four courses a year? You know, what else are they doing? Oh, they're doing research. Well, that's all just so we're paying them to write nonsense, you know? And so in that respect, I think you may see things like state legislatures saying, you know, we insist that the state university keeps tuition at under $12,000 a year without any subsidies from the, you know, from the state treasury, which in effect would mean that you have to give up the research mission.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what happened at CUNY. It's a little more complicated. There's ways to do it, but it definitely will undercut the breadth of research that can be done in an institution. So this morning I read a post by Matt Reed in Inside Higher Ed on absences and how teachers evaluate them in universities. So he's making the case against the practice of judging whether or not to excuse absences on a case-by-case basis. And he's arguing in favor of the practice of giving students a set number of days of permitted absences. Also, so in CUNY, we're not allowed to grade on attendance, and it's a policy that I 100% support. Some people try to skirt the restriction by having a participation grade, but I don't grade on attendance at all. I don't believe in it, and I just wanted to see what you guys thought. Attendance, how does it figure into your grading scheme and your pedagogical strategy?
Well, I pair attendance and participation together. I just say, you know, you have three unexcused absences. You don't have to tell me why you weren't here. I don't really care. Although students tend to want to explain themselves anyway. You know, it's in part, you know, some of my students, I actually think, if they just did the copious amounts of reading that I assigned for the class, right? If they actually did it and thought through it, they could figure things out, right? They don't need to be there 100% of the time, right? Students get sick. Students break up with their significant others, right? Students leave their iPhones in lifts and have to find them, right? You know, that's my whole thing. Like, students are subject to real life stuff. and they're paying for it, right? So my whole thing is like, if you want to waste your parents' money, by all means, do it.
Wait, was that supposed to be a sympathetic example that they go out drinking and then leave their phone in the lift?
No, I didn't say they go out drinking. It could be in the morning.
Yeah, but why else are they taking a lift?
Absent-minded.
Well, I will tell you, here at Georgetown, like so many of these students, right? They take 5 courses a semester, then they intern on the Hill, and then some of them also have to work a job, mm-hmm. right, as well. And they're often going from one part of DC to the next, right? And the only way to get back on campus in time for their club meeting or in time for their lab is by taking a lift.
See, that surprises me because all my friends in DC constantly talk about how efficient the metro is, particularly the escalator system.
Well, there. Well, even given the inefficiency of the metro, there is no metro in Georgetown. Oh, okay. So
yeah, I get it.
Jesse, what do you do for attendance?
I grade on participation, and part of that is attendance, but I have really small discussion-based classes, so if people aren't there, it really matters.
Okay.
But I appreciated the author's point of, they were saying, like, a doctor's note has a classist assumption, and that some people can pay to go to the doctor, and I think that's completely true, and I try to be really clear with the students about the range of things that are acceptable to me, so, like, if you have to take care of a sick grandparent, that's fine. If you have a boss that is going to be, you know, like suddenly demands you show up for work, just let me know. I try to make it like think of all the examples where class might play out differently and say it's not just about being sick. Because I have had students who have missed for things that I would have thought are completely excusable reasons. And then I ask them later why they just hadn't told me earlier. And they're like, oh, well, it wasn't on the syllabus. I didn't know. It was okay. It didn't even occur to me to ask. So I try to be really clear that there's a variety of reasons that are acceptable to miss.
Gabe, what do you think of participation grades or attendance grades?
So I've changed my policy over time. So I mean, I don't take attendance, although I should say the attendance at my classes is appallingly low. And I don't think it's because I'm a uniquely annoying or boring lecturer. I mean, I feel like I'm a pretty compelling speaker and, you know, I got a loud voice. You can hear me. And I'm talking about prostitution and stuff like that. So it seems like people would want to come to class.
They'll fill the seats.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm, you know, shamelessly pandering, but so I used to give pop quizzes on the readings in class. And I would basically follow what Reed is suggesting of saying, I will drop your lowest grade, or I will drop your lowest 2 grades or whatever. And then I would tell them, you know, now you don't need to waste my time with your excuses. Like, I don't need to hear your excuses because you can have any grade you want gets dropped. And I'm just going to do it. And then now this spares us from having to do it. But what I found was that students are incapable of understanding that. They feel like they get one day off because they didn't feel like coming. And then if they have a real reason that they don't have to come, then they get to tell me about it. Hmm. And this idea of, you know, like in the IHE piece, Reed basically says you should encourage them to like save their personal days for emergencies. You know, we are not exactly talking about people who ace the marshmallow test here. you know, they just like, they don't come because, you know, they don't want to have to wake up early and shower and, you know, for a 10 a.m. class. And then, you know, when they actually do have a problem, now they actually have a problem. And so I just got sick of dealing with the excuses. And so I switched to not doing that anymore. And, you know, but I feel like it actually is in their benefit to, you know, if you're not taking attendance, at least do something that for all practical purposes is like attendance, like giving pop quizzes. Mm-hmm. And the reason I feel that this is kind of a paternalistic policy is that it just telling them you don't have to come to class, but you'll do much better on the exams if you come to class. They won't come to class. They need like a micro incentive. Mm. It's too far in advance to say that 10 weeks from now, you're going to take a final and you'll do much better on the final if you've come to class and listened to the lectures. And so if you give them like a point a day for showing up, it's like your kids, right? I mean, if you're talking to like a 10-year-old, you can't tell them if you don't do your homework, you're not going to get into a good college, or then you won't get a good job. I mean, that's just too distant. You got to say you can't use the Xbox if you don't do your homework.
Well, I think that, so I tend to teach much smaller classes than you do, Gabriel, right? I mean,
And for context, we should tell people most of my classes are 150 students.
Yeah, like most of my classes are between 40 and 50, like, you know, except of course, if I'm teaching a seminar. I do take attendance, and I take attendance like sort of in part because I am kind of like a rules following type of employee, yeah. Right? And from what I understand, like, or from the way it was pitched to me during orientation as a faculty member, it's like, well, you are actually kind of responsible for your students. So for example, if the fire alarm goes off or if there's an active shooter, you're responsible for them, right? And so if they go missing, right, and you can't say whether or not they were there in your class that day, that's not so good. And then also on a related note, you know, I don't know if you guys know this about me, but I have a thing about serial killers, and I just want to make sure that none of my students gets picked off by a serial killer, right? I want to be able to have as much detailed information about their lives as possible, you know, when the FBI comes knocking on my door.
Well, I'm glad you're prepared for that contingency. I have found that like students just don't want to come to class. And it's like when I take attendance, I mean, I never took attendance, but when I gave the pop quiz, I would find students would leave straight after the pop quiz. And I'd be like, where the hell are you going? And they're like, oh yeah, I scheduled another class at this time. Or, oh, this class is at the same time as my athletic practice. And I'm like, well, then why the hell did you sign up for this class? And I'm like, oh, because there's a podcast.
Oh, you know
and
why?
It's like,
do you know why?
Yeah.
It's because they have lower confidence in higher education. That's why.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I don't have grading. I don't grade attendance. And I actually generally try to avoid mechanisms that indirectly act as attendance. And the philosophy that I don't think it's been directly pressed on it is almost the opposite of yours, Leslie, that we have. And it's that they're adults and they've purchased, access to, you know, set of learning experiences. And I'd hope that they'd come. But even if they don't, like my whole thing with grading is that there's a set of skills that I'm trying to teach over each module and over the course of the semester. And I grade them based on their mastery of the concept. I guess it's possible that somebody really talented could take my class and blow through everything without having it attended, but I'm okay with that. Am I missing something here? Is there a serious deficiency to my philosophy in this regard?
Well, I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. I mean, this is an extreme case, but I remember my first year teaching. Yeah, I think it was my first year teaching. I was teaching stats. And I had how you get those, what do they call those things where students get to talk about their experience in the classroom? What are these things called?
Evaluation.
Yeah, evaluation is a tool that the institution uses to see whether or not you're being responsive to students. And I remember in my first year, there was one student who wrote that they didn't learn anything in the class at all. And I was like, you want to know something? I bet you I know who that student is. The student who only showed up to class 4 times and failed every single exam. And so, you know what? He was being totally truthful. He learned absolutely nothing in that class, right? I kind of feel like taking attendance and having attendance be part of the grade. I think number one, like students who show up all the time, but are still struggling with the material a little bit. Like it helps give them a bump. You're like, I see that you're trying. I see that you're trying. And, you know, and students who don't show up and don't do well and want to kvetch about it, you can look at your records and see and say, hey, right? You came to class 4 times in 16 weeks. What did you expect?
So, you know, you can do something similar if you just track the reads on Blackboard.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you take a reading access statistics and you post your readings on Blackboard, you can see which kids download them. And when they come at the end of the year, you can pull up a spreadsheet. And invariably, the ones coming to you haven't accessed anything since week 3. Like, well, that might be part of it, you know.
You Yeah, I wanted to talk about this piece that that I read in this past Sunday's New York Times Magazine, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it basically addresses the whole issue of toxic masculinity, but not so much going into, you know, the details of toxic masculinity, but like questioning whether or not it's a meaningful phrase, right? So the author was Lauren Euler, and what she says of toxic masculinity as she reads it is that it describes the strict gender norms that encourage men to repress their emotions and exhibit dominance to the point of aggression. And she has a problem with the ways in which toxic masculinity is used. And as a sociologist, I kind of feel like there are a few things that she says about it that I found fascinating. Not that I necessarily agreed with them, but I found her analysis fascinating, right? The confidence with which these complex phenomena are blamed on a single systemic agent, like i.e. toxic masculinity, it's not unique to debates about women's rights. The image conjured when we use this is one of a passive population, helpless to defend ourselves against the invisible but deadly ideological forces that surround us, corrupting our purity and then turning us into agents of our own destruction. And another critique that she has of it that I also found interesting, she said that, where is this? Yeah, that basically toxic masculinity, I'm paraphrasing, concentrates structural criticism in the symptom, not the cause, suggesting a little cleanup will suffice. So I found this article to be very interesting, especially in light of the past month that we've endured with the Kavanaugh. With the whole sort of Kavanaugh fiasco. So I was wondering what you all thought.
First of all, can you explain this to me a little better? So it's a criticism against the concept of toxic masculinity.
Yes.
Because she sees it as a symptom of a deeper problem, which is what?
Yeah. So it seems to me that number one, right, it's not the cause of our problems. It's the symptom of a problem, right? Number one. And number two, I think part of what she's arguing is that toxic masculinity is often targeted at an individual, right? Like the toxic masculinity resides in this individual, right? And that is used to, you know, either excuse their behavior, right? Or to just sort of focus, you know, the individual as being sort of the cause of all of the bad things that are associated with toxic masculinity, as opposed to saying, well, hey, if there is this thing called toxic masculinity, right, is it really just residing in that individual, right? And even if it is, what is the cause of this, right? And until we start using toxic masculinity, right, in better ways, right, in ways that I think part of what she's saying is, you know what I mean, don't use it as an excuse. Don't say structure is the excuse, but actually looking at what is actually embedded in our structures and our systems and try and figure out what the root of this toxic masculinity is. Now, I should actually point out that, you know, she's not coming at this as an academic, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting because I'm an academic reading a non-academic take on toxic masculinity.
Yeah, when I'm glad you explained it to me, because when I read it, I couldn't tell if it was I just thought it was an incoherent argument. Mm-hmm. And now you're saying that it's a critique of an argument as being incoherent.
Yes.
I think there's a third possibility, which is an incoherent critique of an incoherent argument.
Well, I mean, so I may, like, I'm sure I gave it a bit of a generous read, in part because I will say that the whole, like, past 2 weeks, right, has filled me with quite a bit of rage, right? Mm. And if I were just sitting down writing about this, right, I might be a bit incoherent as well.
Well, let's talk about coherency, though, because that's kind of what the Sokol Squared people were dinging us with. Is toxic masculinity, is it a well-formed, well-defined concept that is based on sound research, or is it part of what they call grievance studies, where they're just broad labels attached to status groups that people might harbor animus towards?
It feels like a vague concept to me. That's the funny thing is that we don't really use concepts like that in sociology, even though if you asked your grandma, she'd say that we do. But it strikes me as a pretty vague concept. I mean, I kind of have an idea of what it means, and I think it has, like, at its core, kind of a meaningful concept. And I'll talk a little bit about how later about, you know, where I think it's useful to distinguish different aspects of masculinity. But like, in the ways that I thought it was incoherent is, like, this dig at Scott Pruitt, mm-hmm. where, you know, that is just a pun, but it's not, and it's a pun at the expense of a point, where she basically says, like, oh, he was a toxic boss, and ironically, he was promoting toxic water. And it's like, okay, that's just a pun on the word toxic. Mm. But, and it's like, A, he was, you know, not exactly on the ball when it came to, you know,
not being corrupt,
you know, parts per million or whatever. And also he does seem like an epically terrible boss, but it's like, was he a terrible boss in a distinctly masculine way? Like, I don't think so. Like, what I've read about Scott Pruitt, he sounds like a really bad version of, what's that Anne Hathaway movie?
A Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It sounds like, you know, The Devil Wears Prada for men.
Yeah, no. So Gabriel, yeah. So that wasn't her point there at all. She's interrogating the use of the word toxic, period, right? As a signifier. So toxic boss, right? It's funny because actually he was literally in charge of this thing that increased the toxicity in drinking water. I mean, she goes on and she goes through and she interrogates, the origins of the word toxic. And she talks about the modern use of the word toxic, right? Yeah. And she does that without using it as, you know, a modifier of masculinity. So that actually might be where some of the sort of confusion is throughout. She's not specifically talking about toxic masculinity. She's interrogating the use of the word toxic, period. Right. And part of me actually, you know, was thinking, I think that there are actually some gender theorists out there that would say toxic masculinity is kind of redundant, right?
Oh, like all masculinity is toxic?
Well, yeah, like masculinity is not a good thing, right? And it's masculinity in and of itself, or more broadly, strict like gender norms themselves, right? That are unhealthy.
Yeah, so, I mean, here's where I wanted to get to with like different dimensions of it. I mean, to the extent that I think there's anything to this concept at all, I think you kind of have to distinguish it. And so I'm a big fan of the Norwegian novel Kristin Lavransdatter, and it's about the titular character is Kristin, who's a woman, and it mm-hmm. covers basically her entire life. But the two big male figures in her life are her father Lavrans, who's kind of the perfect dad, and Erland, her husband, who's like, you know, one of the great bad boys of literature. And, you know, like one of the first dates, he's basically like, you know, I'm no good for you, Kristin, you know? So, and actually a friend of mine who was reading the book with me, she texted me and she's like, oh my God, this fucking guy, you know, with that passage where he's like, you know, I'm no good for you, Kristin. So, you know, but the funny thing about it is that both Lavrans and Erland are intensely masculine. They're just masculine in different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, Lavran is like a total dad, and Erland is like the total bad boy. But neither of them really does it. You know, Lavrans would never in a million years womanize. And Erland would, was not a good father or even a good husband. But both of them were highly masculine. Neither of them were wusses. I guess I shouldn't make metaphors based on novels you guys haven't read.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Yeah. No, it's fine. I mean, I think it brings up the whole notion of what is it we mean when we talk about this thing called masculinity, mm-hmm. right? You know, and is there one hegemonic masculinity, right? I guess it depends on the context. But this notion of toxic masculinity, at least in the way that it's crept into sort of kind of like mainstream audiences and the media. And I think in particular, although she doesn't focus on it, like this is the way kind of she introduces the use of the phrase is in, you know, blaming toxic masculinity for sexual assault and sexual harassment, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, so I want to bring in another non-academic New York Times author who talks about masculinity, which is Ross Douthat has been talking for a while mm-hmm. about this idea that there's like, you know, we saw this shift in the 1960s where, you know, there's a notion of patriarchy and masculinity and all that sort of thing, but it's kind of an ambiguous concept. And he likes to point out that there's really two aspects to it. There's the kind of dad style and then like the playboy style. And he sometimes refers to the latter as Hefnerism mm-hmm. as if it was like, you know, an explicit ideology, which in some ways it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he likes to point out that you kind of have like, if you imagine like Hugh Hefner, and then you have like, you know, your classic, like somewhat patriarchal, but like dad type, like, you know, Mitt Romney or something. And then you have on the third part, you have notions that are skeptical of masculinity and, you know, and basically feminism. There's this weird thing where it's like this triangular system where one side can't always tell the difference between the other two. Mm-hmm. And also, to the extent they can tell, they'll kind of strategically ally because none of the three really wants any of the other three to win.
And now we turn to Jesse Strieb from Duke University. Jesse is the author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages with Oxford University Press. More recently, she published The Unbalanced Theoretical Toolkit, Problems and Partial Solutions to Studying Culture and Reproduction, but Not Cultural Immobility in the American Journal of Cultural Sociology. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for joining us, Jesse.
Thanks for inviting me.
So before we get into your latest piece in the American Journal of Cultural Sociology, which is a great piece, can you tell us a little bit about your book, The Power of the Past?
Yeah, sure.
What's it about?
So it's a book about cross-class marriages, but I think more than that, it's a book about upward mobility and how people who are upwardly mobile think about kind of all aspects of life compared to their partners who grew up in the middle class and are still in the middle class. So it's kind of about like, do upwardly mobile people assimilate? And these are the people who you would think are the most likely to assimilate. So they married middle class people, they are themselves now in the middle class, they have the resources of being in the middle class, they raise their kids with middle class people, they live in middle class neighborhoods. So how much kind of does your class stick with you and how much do you change?
And how much does it stick with you?
A lot, it turns out. In what ways?
Yeah, like can you give us sort of flesh it out for us? Like yeah. how can you get the money, get all the trimmings of the next step up on the hierarchy and still not be part of it?
Yeah, I mean, and they are part of it in some ways. They just kind of systematically think about things differently than people born into the middle class. So I look at a lot of different dimensions of daily life. So how do you think about money? How do you think about work, raising your kids, housework, leisure, emotions, and compare it to their partners who grew up in the middle class? And what I find is that people who are upwardly mobile tend to have what I call a laissez-faire approach. So they're just like, you know, we'll take it as it comes. Let's not do all this planning. You know, let's just figure it out when we need to figure it out. And the people who are born in the middle class want to plan and organize everything. So if you think about Annette LaRose's book about concerted cultivation and parenting styles, it's like the upper middle class people, how they raise their kids is how they run their whole life. So, you know, where they're telling their kids, you have to be here at this time, you have to do this, this is your goal, we're going to try to meet it, here's how you talk to people, here's how you organize things to meet your goals. That's everything. That's not just their kids. Whereas like the accomplishment of natural growth style of raising your kids, which is like much more relaxed, is how working upwardly mobile people from the working class in my sample want to do everything, not just raise their kids.
I have a question about that, Jesse. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering whether or not you see whether there's a gender story here, right? So number one, the people in your sample, are men just as likely to be marrying women who were born into a class above the one that they were born into? Or are women more likely to be doing that? Or is it kind of equal?
It's fairly equal now. So these are all people who are now college educated, but grew up in different classes. So I think mm-hmm. you would see something different if you were looking at kind of cross-class marriages by your current class position. And then the gender stuff also plays out in how they think about some things. So with parenting, men who grew up in the middle class are still a little more hands-off. And mm-hmm. And so there's a different dynamic there. And how they respond to their partners is sometimes gendered. So the couples that really struggle the most were often women who grew up in the middle class and men who didn't. So they have this, the wife would be like, you have to, she's basically trying to manage her husband, right? This is how you raise the kids. This is how we organize our time. This is what we do on the weekends. And the guy, you know, you can imagine the gender norms or the gender dynamics playing out there. And he just strongly believes like, no, my way, like we don't have to plan everything. That's not the only way to do our lives. I'm not doing it wrong. I'm just doing it differently. And there's a good reason why I'm doing it this way. And those marriages were really hard often.
Interesting. And wait, when you say the middle class, you mean college educated?
Yeah, college educated and a professional job.
So people who came from a family where there was no college into a college, they themselves got college educated and married a college educated person whose right. parents were college. I gotcha. Okay. All right. And then what was the reception of the book? Like what came out once you sent it off into the world? What came back to you?
Oh, a lot of media stuff. And yeah, I think a lot of people have told me it helps explain their lives. Class is so, I think the way Americans think about it is so, like, class is just money, right? And that our money has no effect on how we think about how we want to live our lives. And so I've gotten a lot of emails from just kind of random people about, like, you helped my marriage, you helped me explain. Nice. Yeah, it's really nice. I mean, sometimes I'm like, I have no advice. Like, I don't have an agenda of like people need to stay married or they don't. Yeah. So sometimes,
please,
like,
Professor Stribe, save my marriage.
Right, and I get some of that. I'm just like, oh my, like I don't know if saving your marriage is the right thing to do or not. Like, right. I don't know you or your partner. But people seem to take it that way often.
Sure.
Yeah, so that's been nice because the reason I wanted to write this book was to help people understand that class matters in these various ways that we don't usually think about. And it wasn't as much about marriage. So it's nice when people say like, oh, I never realized I spent money the way I do because of how I was raised, or I never thought about the way I expressed my emotions as a reflection of my class position.
I'm going to guess that about 90% of the people who, you know, emailed you saying, oh, this helped me understand my own marriage were, you know, the high strung overthinking it types who themselves grew up.
Exactly. Yes. I should also mention, I got the opposite too of like, you're a class warrior, which I found really weird because this is like the least class warrior book I can think about writing about class, you know, how people from different classes love each other and get along and make their marriages work. But I think there's just so much aversion to the word class that, you know, any mention of it is like, you must be trying to bring down the class system.
Anything other than an emphatic denial of its existence is not good right. enough for a certain class. So one more question on that book. So what were the big sort of lessons that you walked away from, the stuff that you personally, the big insights that you personally came away from, shook your worldview over the course of doing this research?
I would say how people thought about money was exactly the opposite is what I thought I would find. So people who were upwardly mobile often said like, oh, I just don't want to think about money. I just want to spend money the way I want to in the moment. And so I like describe themselves as impulsive about money and spending more freely. And the people from the middle class wanted a budget and they wanted to stick to it. And they described themselves and their partners described them as kind of more, less likely to want to spend money. And that's completely the opposite of what we see on college campuses often, which is working class people, students criticizing upper middle class students and rich students for freely spending money all the time. But the way this respondents explained it to me made a lot of sense, which was we grew up having to watch spending money our whole lives and being told once you have more money, your life will be better. And so now I have more money. So why would I be so budgeting about it? Like, why would I not just spend it? So there was that narrative. And then also a narrative of like, we didn't have any extra money. And so all of our money had to be spent. And so what I learned was when you have money, you spend money. Because there was no other way to survive. And they kind of describe themselves as still in that mode. So that surprised me. And then just, you know, this is the sample that's like least likely to stick with the things they were raised with. And it seems like that's what happened. So the fact that your class sticks with you for so long and in such a systematic way also surprised me.
Does it matter whether you have kids or not?
Everybody in my sample had kids, so I'm not.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your more recent piece, the Unbalanced Theoretical Toolkit. And we'll start with the basic concepts. It's about culture and mobility. What do you mean by the relationship for the intersection of culture and mobility?
So just about how we think and what we believe and what strategies we take and how that relates to what class we end up in compared to the class we started in. So the kind of history of this is that most work in sociology, basically all work in sociology, with a few exceptions, has been about how the way we think and act and what we believe keeps us in our class that we were born into. And that's been going on for maybe 100 years. And we have almost nothing about how the ways you think and act and what you believe might shape if you're upwardly or downwardly mobile. So I want to kind of introduce that if we think class matters for reproduction, we should probably think it matters for mobility too.
So wait, to put it into different words. So people have traditionally felt like there's an upper middle class way of being versus a working class way of being. And the assumption might have been if you're working class and you want to be upper middle class, you adopt their behaviors. But you're saying that might not be the same type of behaviors or beliefs or worldviews that you need to move up. Is that
right. Well, it could be. So basically the only thing that we now think about the culture and upward mobility is basically if you assimilate. So basically the idea is upper middle class people have a way of being that they define as the best way of being and that they're going to judge other people against. And they don't necessarily understand that that's related to the class that they live in. And so they judge other people by these standards that they can't meet because they don't have the resources to meet them. And so the only people who are going to be upwardly mobile are the people who figure out basically how to fake looking like an upper middle class person. So that's our current idea.
Right.
And right. I want to say like, well, maybe that's not the only way. Like maybe some upper middle class people do appreciate parts of working class culture, if you want to call it that. And maybe they would reward that too.
Well, isn't that part of the kind of the argument that Seamus Khan makes in his book Privilege, right? And he's like, this is what all of the sort of fancy boarding schools and prep schools are doing now, right? They're teaching students to not only appreciate quote unquote high culture, highbrow culture, but also quote unquote lowbrow culture and thinking about the ways in which the two connect and showing that you were this like fluid citizen of these different worlds and being able to navigate both supposedly is evidence of, you know, of your savvy, of like your knowledge and your coolness, etc.
I think that concept, Leslie, strikes me as so comical. Like you go to a school whose primary purpose is to segregate you from everybody who's not like you, and then you have a curriculum.
So yeah. It's like let's read Moby Dick and compare it to Kendrick Lamar's latest.
Let's talk. Yeah, right. It's like let's talk about the blacks and what they think about it. Is that how that's going to play out?
Kind of.
Anyway, I'm sure it's a wonderful curriculum. So
Guys, I'm going to have to go because I need to rewrite my lecture that I'm giving in an hour based on, you know, what we've just been discussing.
What are the traits that your research suggests might be cultural traits that might be important for upward mobility?
Yeah, so one is we know from a lot of research that working class people tend to be better at dealing with instability. Mm. So like the world changes quickly around you and you've got to adapt and kind of stay calm and figure out what to do in a crisis. That's a lot of working class people's lives all the time when they're growing up. And so it's pretty, can be normal, and they often can adapt more quickly and figure out a solution. And so if you're in an industry, if you're like an employer that you feel like everything's changing quickly around you and your employees aren't changing fast enough with the times, like maybe hiring somebody from a working class background would be the smart way to go. So that's one. Middle class people are generally more individualistic because they don't need to rely on other people mm-hmm. to do what they need to do, whereas working class people tend to grow up needing to rely on other people and growing up in smaller spaces so that you kind of have to get along with other people more often. And so,
okay, so middle class are more individualistic.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And working class people tend to, by necessity, have to get along with people more. And so they often learn how to do it better. And you can see that, you know, in my research on preschoolers and Jessica Calarco's research on elementary school students, like it's the working class kids who get in conflicts less often in school. And so if what you want are people who are really team oriented, you know, working class people are people who grew up in the working class are often better at it. These are, of course, you know, like huge generalizations, and there's a lot of, sure. you know, variation within every class. But on average, working class people are better at teamwork. So things like that are things like that I think are skills that lots of people think we need and we value. And that people who grew up in the working class are more likely to have.
Is there kind of like a sorting mechanism here? So is it people who grew up in the middle class who then somehow made it like into the middle class that you're talking about? Yeah. Or are you talking about working class people in general? Because thinking about my own background and what my elementary school looked like, there were a lot of fights. And I remember then going off to high school, right, where mm-hmm. the vast majority of the students in my school were not working class. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I saw a fight in that context, it was the most shocking thing I'd ever seen, right? Is there this sort of sorting element to this?
Right, so like it's working class people in middle class context. Right. And so I think it also just looks different. So you wouldn't necessarily have fights in middle class communities, like fist fights, but you would have disagreements over the best way to proceed about something, which is mm-hmm. a very different sort of fight. But people might stick to their guns a little bit more on that, whereas people who grew up in the working class might be able to be the person who finds the common ground more easily.
Got it.
Jesse, have you ever looked into the opposite situation where people from higher classes find themselves in working class contexts, like a downward mobility?
We don't know a ton about that. So I'm writing a book on downward mobility right now, but it's not exactly about like how do they navigate mm-hmm. a working class world once they're there. I mean, presumably they're not prepared in the same way that people who grew up in the working class would be. So there's a few examples of this. So Lindsay Owens has a piece about people who their house goes into foreclosure and what to do about that. And she finds working class people are much better at navigating that. They're not as ashamed to reach out to their networks. And so they get more help more quickly. They kind of know what to look out for in terms of scams because they've experienced more people trying to scam them before. And so they're better at avoiding them. She has one other reason why working class people are better at dealing with this. But probably just they know more other people who have had the same issue. And so they know how to navigate it better.
I loved the idea of disadvantages as advantages in your work. Can you say a little bit about that?
Sure. People who grew up with disadvantages can talk about them in a way that can help them. So Lauren Rivera finds this in her study of people who are applying for jobs at elite firms in finance and consulting and banking. And so basically they tell stories of like a rags to riches narrative. Mm. And she finds that as long as you don't blame other people and you're not resentful, that if you just kind of describe it as I work so hard and this is where I came from, and then people really respond to that. And you can think of there being a lot of those types of narratives that only people who grew up poor or working class could tell. So there's the rags to riches one, but you could tell a story of a working class hero. Like, I went into the military for a while. I was a soldier and, brave, and I can really use the skills I learned in helping people and in exhibiting fearlessness in a different type of job. Or just like, I'm good at overcoming things. I don't let obstacles get me down. For example, I had, my family didn't have a lot of money, but we persisted in this way. So there's ways to kind of frame it in ways that other people might really appreciate and value and reward. And you can't really tell that story credibly if you grew up in the upper middle class.
Nice.
Well, that's interesting because quite a few of my students actually try and spin their tails.
Well, you can tell it's not
funny. Right? No, whatever. I'm not saying this to cast aspersions on those students, but I actually think that that is a form of storytelling, this narrative form that I believe more and more students are learning in high school, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's this thing to prepare you for when you write your college essays, right? Yep. When you have to talk about how you overcame adversity, right? et cetera, right? Except I think, especially for my much more affluent students, I actually think for them, the opposite is true. They need to be able to show how they couldn't have actually, they couldn't have persevered without a community or without the benefits that they had, right? And how they can empathize with other people who may not be as fortunate as they were, who, given the same adversity, may not have come through it. And so I think there's this very, very, I kind of feel like, this is part of the strategy of how young people are actually learning to sort of spin their class and spin their class background.
Yeah. And I think it's really hard to tell a good story of how you grew up with privilege, but now you empathize or something and you see tons of bad versions of it, right? Like,
oh yeah, I've seen this.
I was but a lowly son of a guy who owned 6 car dealerships across Eastern Iowa.
Yeah, but they were only domestic cars.
Yeah. Economy domestic. No Mercedes dealership in my household.
Yeah, this was actually the subject of Ross Douthat's column this weekend, where he was talking about kind of like gradations of class among extraordinarily privileged people and how there's like this pressure to kind of like, like you have the upper middle class comparing themselves to the upper class, but that's basically all there is at elite schools, right? I mean, if you look at, really top schools, like something like less than 10% of the students come from below the median for household income, which, I know isn't exactly the same thing as class, but, it's decent proxy.
Close enough.
Well, one of my favorite examples actually is when one of Michael Bloomberg's daughters, she started this like kind of like this charity to actually give gently used riding equipment and clothing to the
riding, like,
unfortunate
horses?
Students who couldn't. Like horses who could not afford to buy their own new like riding equipment. And I was like, wow. Yeah.
They got the huge
That's
chaps.
Straight out of Clueless when she's like collecting ski equipment
in New York City of all places. Right. I mean, how many horses are there in New York? I mean, they're yeah, surprisingly more than
surprise,
you would think.
Yeah.
But still. No, yeah. Surprise, no. Like, I know the stables in Brooklyn, but still.
Yeah. Be like, oh, I had ragged chaps, I tell you.
See, that's a rags to riches story right there.
So, Jesse, you're working on another book? You want to tell us about what you got in the works right now? Sneak peek?
Yeah. So I'm working on a book on how white upper middle class students, kids born into the upper middle class, end up downwardly mobile. So I'm using the NSYR data, the National Study of Youth and Religion, which has, they've done this amazing job of collecting longitudinal interviews over 11 years as kids turn from teenagers to young adults. And they follow 267 kids using these interviews from across the U.S. And one really cool thing about it is, like, I feel like most qualitative studies are in New England, or they're in California, or they're in New York. And this is kids from across the country. So rural areas, Idaho, Utah, places that most sociologists don't go. And just looking at what's the difference between the kids who stay in their class and the kids who leave in terms of kind of how they approach school and college, work and marriage. So hopefully that book will be out in 2 years.
All right.
We'll see.
Well, hopefully you'll come back when you have it out to talk about it.
Yeah, I hope so. All
right. You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. Special thank you to Jessie Strybe of Duke University. Her piece in the American Journal of Cultural Sociology is The Unbalanced Theoretical Toolkit, Problems and Partial Solutions to Studying Culture and Reproduction, but Not Culture Mobility. She also wrote The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages with Oxford University Press. We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at @SocAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. On behalf of Leslie Hinkson and Gabriel Rossman, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.